Okay. So let us continue where we left off before. And we are looking at the sutta, which is here called Ignorance, which is the sutta, the first sutta about the Noble Eightfold Path. Ignorance here being avijja in Pali, and really meaning something like delusion or lack of understanding or lack of insight or not seeing things according to reality and all of these kind of things. And I just want to just say a little bit more about this sutta, because we had to sort of finish off fairly rapidly there this morning. And looking at the positive side of things, how the Noble Eightfold Path works, how it is a conditioned sequence starting with right view and ending with right stillness or samadhi at the very end. And one of the things I pointed out is that really it is a path of purification. That's really what the Noble Eightfold Path is. And the reason for that is because once you have a degree of right view into place, you understand that one of the things you understand is that you have to purify yourself if you're going to be able to see things clearly, because defilements distort your outlook, they distort your ability to see clearly. Desires, anger, ill will, these are vested interests that make it almost impossible for us. It makes it impossible, actually, to see things clearly. So you have to purify yourself to be able to see things as they actually are, according to reality. Yeah, and of course, that is the ultimate purpose, to see things clearly. Because seeing things clearly basically just means that you understand suffering, you understand happiness, and you understand how to get these things. In other words, the path to get there as well. That is what clarity is all about. That's what right view is about, seeing the world in the right way. So it is a path of purification, and to purify yourself is always a gradual process. You have to start off with a more serious defilements, the more serious problems of the mind. Yeah, so that's why we start off with things like ordinary virtue, right speech, right action, right livelihood. You start with the more serious problems in life. You purify that first of all. Then when you have purified your main aspects of virtue, you go on to the mental aspects. That is in large part what right effort is about. Looking at the world in such a way that we reduce ill will, you reduce desires, and you reduce any other defilements of the mind, largely by perceiving the world in the right way, perceiving people in the right way. It is astonishing, actually. It is when people often think that overcoming anger, for example, is quite difficult, but actually it is not that difficult to reduce ill will quite substantially. It's all about how we look at other people, how we look at the world around us. Looking at it in the right way, and things start to calm down. And this is what right effort is about. And then when you have done that to the point where mindfulness starts to arise, it is desire and ill will. These are the things that lead us into the past and the future. Desire is always about the future. Ill will is often about the past. Desire is about where you want to be, where you are not, but where you want to be. Ill will is often about what people have done to us in the past you are upset about. So these are the things that take you out of the present moment. As you reduce these defilements, the mind naturally moves into the present moment. It achieves clarity, and that is where mindfulness arises. Sammasati, Satipatthana, the seventh factor of the Noble Eightfold Path. Meditation becomes possible because the mind starts to be centered in the present moment. It's very logical once you start to see this. Yeah, it actually makes really good sense. It's not very kind of hard to grasp, but this actually must be the way the path works, the way the mind works. So now you can start watching the breath. Watching the breath is one way of doing satipatthana practice. And satipatthana is then the way any remaining defilements of the mind, very fine defilements of the mind, are overcome through satipatthana practice, through sammasati, the right mindfulness. If you look at the Satipatthana Sutta, it's all about understanding, getting rid of attachment to the body. It's like the first Satipatthana, Kaya Nupassana, contemplation of the body. And you have understanding various types of feelings, overcoming the unwholesome ones. In the fourth Satipatthana is about the five hindrances and some other subject, but the five hindrances, one of the most important ones in the fourth Satipatthana, the Dhamma Nupassana, understanding the five hindrances, understanding how they arise, understanding how they disappear, understanding what keeps them away for the future. Insight into that, this is where insight also comes into it, understanding this process. So Satipatthana is this process of purifying the mind to the point where the five hindrances are absolutely gone. And this is quite difficult. It is quite difficult because these hindrances are so refined, it's often very difficult to even see that they are there. They are like the final remnants that block you from entering samadhi. So what is Satipatthana practice? Satipatthana is this process that happens after you purify the mind from right effort, before you enter samadhi. It is that process in between there, the process of watching the breath, the process of attaining insight into your defilements, the process of using meditation in such a way that it leads you to the full samadhi, the jhanas, and all that. That is what it is really about. Is it insight? Is it samatha? Is it vipassana? It's both. Yeah. Remember the purpose of the path. If you attain samatha, if you get some calm, your vipassana always comes with it. Clear seeing comes with the samatha. With the samatha comes vipassana. With the vipassana comes samatha. These things are always used as a compound in the sutta. Samatha, vipassana, two qualities of mind that arise together. It is not used as a meditation technique in the suttas. It is used as qualities of the mind that arise out of right meditation practice. When you reduce the defilements, the result is twofold. Yeah, and that result is always samatha and vipassana. They have the same source, the same cause that gives rise to these two things, the reduction in the defilements. When the defilements are less, you feel more calm because the desire and ill will is what makes your mind restless and agitated. When you have less desire and ill will, your mind has more clarity because there's less vested interest in the phenomena of the world. So you have more clarity. Calm and insight always go together. You have one, you will have the other. So this is what Satipatthana is about on the Noble Eightfold Path, and that is why it is squeezed in there between right effort and Samma Samadhi. It leads to Samadhi eventually. So this is how it works out. When you see Satipatthana in this kind of context, it starts to become quite clear what its purpose on the path is. If you only read the Satipatthana Sutta, you get one idea of Satipatthana. But if you read all the context that it is found in, if you read the whole Satipatthana Sanghutta, if you get to understand the Noble Eightfold Path and all these other aspects of how to practice the path, the bhujangas, the indriyas, and all this, you see the connection between these various factors. And that's where you gain a full understanding of what is going on. And then you get to Samma Samadhi. At that point, your mind is fully purified. The hindrances are completely gone. Yeah, and this is kind of the idea with this. And that is when insight, real insight, becomes possible. The vijjas, the things that liberate you from samsaric existence. And on the way, on that path, it may sound very dry when you hear it like this. Yeah, you overcome defilements. It doesn't sound very inspiring to overcome defilements. Yeah, but remember that every time you overcome some defilement, you feel so much better for it. You feel more happy. You have more joy in your life. You feel more at ease with other people around you. You have more metta. You have more compassion. All of these things grow together. So remember, there's always a reverse side. There's like the dry side or the negative side. We get rid of defilements. We practice the right speech or whatever. But all of these things have a very powerful positive side as well. It is a happy path. Yeah, it's not the kind of dry path, which is just dry. And then, you know, and then kind of you, yeah, whatever. So that is really what this Noble Eightfold Path is about. And this is how it works. This conditioned phenomena, starting with right view, ending up with Samma Samadhi at the other end. So now what I want to do next is to look at this path in detail. I'm going to have a look at each of the factors, starting off with right view. I'm going to look at the definition for right view. There's a few different definitions of right view in the suttas, and then talk about those definitions in quite a bit of detail. So the next sutta here is called analysis. This Pali word for this is vibhanga. This is the standard way that a right view is defined in the suttas. This is what how the Buddha explains it. And what is right view? Right view is the knowledge, or if you like, the understanding of suffering, the knowledge of the origin of suffering, the knowledge of the end of suffering, and the knowledge of the way leading to the end of suffering. This is called right view. Yeah, and again, one of the important things to understand about this is that this also has like a reverse side to it. Yeah, it's not just about suffering, because if you understand suffering, you also understand happiness. If you have knowledge of suffering, you also have knowledge of happiness. If you have knowledge of the origin of suffering, it means you also understand the cessation of happiness. If you know the cessation of suffering, you know the origin of happiness. And if you know the path leading to the end of suffering, you also know the path leading to the arising of happiness. These are just the inverse, again, of this. And be wise as Buddhists. Yeah, we have to be wise about this. We have to know how to package these teachings in the right way. We have to know how to our marketing in a way where it's attractive to other people. This is so important, I think, when we talk about the Dhamma, not to kind of do things according to a set way of doing things, but looking at these teachings with new eyes and new ways. How are they relevant to our modern society? How can we sell these teachings in a way people can actually grasp what is going on? And too often people say, oh, Buddhism is so pessimistic, it's all about suffering, but actually it isn't. Any one of you who have been a Buddhist for a long time, you know it's not true at all. It's often the exact opposite. It's about joy, about happiness, about all of these kind of things. Yeah, the reason why the Buddha presents it in terms of suffering, this is an important point to understand, is because these teachings are very profound. And from the most profound view, from the view of an awakened mind, it is about suffering. But you can really only see that when you are fully awakened. Yeah, for ordinary people, it's much more important to show other sides of this. Show the happy side of these teachings. Show that every time you are kind, when you sit down to meditate, you achieve mindfulness, you achieve joy arises with that, energy comes with that, clarity comes with that. It's powerful stuff. It's very beautiful and very attractive. And this is really what these teachings, there's another side of looking at these teachings, a more simple side, down-to-earth side, not as profound, but precisely because it is not so profound, it is actually more applicable for most people. They can actually relate to this. Most people can't relate to non-self and, how five khandhas are suffering. If you say to the ordinary person that the five khandhas are suffering, they say, oh, yeah, whatever, and they walk off, and you never see them again, because they just can't relate to that. So we have to market things. Yeah, we've got to be smart. So we should have some smart marketeers. Isn't there marketing here in this group? We need to draw more on the resources of the Buddhist Society. We have so many members of the Buddhist Society, so many clever and sharp people in the Buddhist Society. We should find some of these kind of marketing gurus, who can kind of come in and think about this. Or is that dodgy? I don't know. I'm kind of making things up a little bit as I go along here, so don't take me too seriously here. Anyway, Four Noble Truths, understanding suffering. Remember, this is a very profound way of seeing reality. This comes from the Buddha's awakening mind. And so what does this actually mean? And what it means, in the most profound sense, this is the insight that you have as you become a stream enter. A stream enter sees these four noble truths. Yeah, and of course, the stream enter has basically the same insight as the Buddha had. Yeah, that's what the stream enter has. So the stream enter has a full insight into reality. That is what it means. Only the stream enter has the full insight into these four noble truths. But as you practice this path and as you gain more of an ordinary and worldly right view, you are starting to gain that insight yourself. Yeah, it is not complete yet, it is not full, but any kind of right view into the Buddha's teachings to some extent a right view into these four noble truths. You start to see where happiness lies. Yeah, you start to understand actually all this running around in the world, getting all this stuff. Yeah, how much happiness is it going to give me here? How much, isn't the mind perhaps more important? What is really going to you know, what can I sustain into the future? If there is a rebirth, what will I take with me? And all of these kind of things. You start to change your outlook. You start to look at things differently. You start to understand happiness is to be found in a place where perhaps most people are not looking for it. And remember, it is not good just to being another sheep. Yeah, most people, kind of the world says, you know, do this. What's it? Okay, have an education, get married, have children, work really, really hard, and then you become a pensioner, and then you die, yeah? This is what you have to do. And you say, yes, sir, or yes, ma'am, and you do exactly that, just like any other sheep in this world. But if you're going to be a sheep, you're going to suffer like a sheep, yeah? Sheep are not usually all that happy. Yeah, sheep are not usually the ones who find the answer to the meaning of life. Sheep are not the ones who bliss out and really see things in a more deep way. To be able to see things differently, you have to stand back a little bit and stand back, you know, and actually look at the life in a different way. Not to be a sheep. You can choose either to be a sheep or you can be happy. You cannot be both. Yes, please don't be a sheep. Think for yourself. Be wise about these things. And then there is a chance that you actually will move forward and you will achieve some of these things. So gradually your right view is aligned with these four noble truths until one day the big insight comes, the life-changing insight where you see these things fully. In the meantime, we are just approximating. So it is still valid for ordinary people, only to a slightly lesser extent. So Now I'm going to look at a few suttas which deal with right view, and the very first one I'm going to have a look at is a little bit perhaps not directly related to right view, but kind of indirectly. And this sutta is called the Kesaputya Sutta, often called the Kalama Sutta in common for most people. And I want to have a look at that because it is kind of very basic ideas about how we think about the world, yeah, and how to take personal responsibility ultimately for our spiritual life. It's become a very famous sutta, and the reason it's become very famous in recent decades is because it kind of fits in with the inquiring mind, yeah, with kind of people who like to be free thinkers, or whatever they call themselves these days. Yeah, it kind of fits with that idea. In the suttas, it's only really found once. I think the ideas are found maybe one or two other places in roughly the same way. In the suttas, it's just one sutta among many, but because it kind of fits in with the modern ideas of things, kind of it becomes more important, it gets more intention than probably it deserves to have. But anyway, it is an interesting sutta regardless. I want to have a look at that. So, this sutta is found in the Anguttara Nikaya 3, number 65, and this is how it goes. On one occasion, the Blessed One was wandering on tour among the Kosalans, together with a large sangha of monks, when he reached a town of the Kalamas named Kesaputta. The Kalamas of Kesaputta heard, "It is said that the ascetic Gotama, the son of the Sakyans, who went forth from the Sakyan family, has arrived at Kesaputta. Now a good report about that master Gotama has circulated thus." I'll read out that report in a second. It's a very standard kind of definition of the Buddha. But before I do that, just very briefly, just remark on what is happening here. In the early days of the Buddha, after his awakening, one of the things that he did was wandering around a lot. Towards the end of his life, he seemed to have been more stably based at Savati, which was the capital of the Kosalan kingdom. But before that, he actually toured around a lot, wandering around, teaching people everywhere. You know, this is kind of one of the traditional ways that the Buddhism was spread in India in the early days, by monks wandering around, settling down in a suitable place, and then teaching the locals. And so here we have this group of people called the Kalamas, and there's a town called Kesaputta. It is not really a very important town. It is kind of just found, I think, pretty much in this sutta, not many other places as far as I can recall. I didn't really check it up before I came here, so I can't be absolutely sure, but I don't think it's a very important place, so probably a fairly small town. In India, in those days, everything was fairly small scale compared to modern cities, at least. These Kalamas, as we shall see later on, they didn't really know much about Buddhism. Yeah, they had never really heard about the Buddha before or heard about his teachings, and they were very uncertain about what teachings to believe in and what not to believe in. So they were like ignorant. They were kind of, they were kind of searching around the spiritual supermarket, trying to find a teaching that was suitable for them, just like people do these days, yeah? Kind of hearing about this, hearing about that, trying to find a teaching which is suitable for guiding your life. Very interesting that India, at that time, the religious life of India was very pluralistic. There was a large number of competing ideas, a large number of competing religions, and people wandering around trying to gain disciples. Yeah, and you had all these debates. Famously, the Indians were very fierce debaters. Yeah, and in the suttas, as I mentioned the other day, they were like saying, "Ah, your doctrine is refuted. Save your doctrine if you can. I'm right. You are wrong." This kind of thing. This is how it is expressed in the suttas. So they were very confused because they had heard all of these various teachings. They didn't know what to believe. And this is a very important background for really understanding this sutta properly, to know that they were confused. They didn't know what was going on. But then they hear that this great ascetic Gautama, yeah, the son of the Sakyans, why is that mentioned? And the reason the son of the Sakyans is mentioned is because the Sakyans were an aristocratic clan that was part of the Kosalan kingdom. And because it was an aristocratic clan, these were people at the very top of the social hierarchy in ancient India. The Buddha was born at the very top of the social hierarchy. So if somebody goes forth, yes, who was at the very top of the social hierarchy, then you assume there must be a very good reason for going forth. If you go forth because, you're old and sick and, you lost your wife or you lost your husband and, you haven't really got much prospect anymore, I guess I might as well go forth, It's not so inspiring, yeah? It's not really, okay, it doesn't really kind of do so much. But if somebody goes forth who is intelligent, they have got a good family, they have wealth, they have everything in life, and still they go forth, that makes you think, what's going on here? How come they go forth? Maybe there's something to these teachings. Maybe these teachings are really profound. And this is kind of the point about the Buddhist teachings. It doesn't matter how wealthy, how intelligent, how clever, how skilled you are in worldly terms. The Dhamma stands way, way above all of that. And this is kind of the point. So whenever you hear, I always hear, people want to go forth and you ask them, what does your family think about it? And I was like, no, my family is so against it. Yeah, my family really hates the idea of me going forth. And of course, the reason why the family doesn't like the idea is because the family doesn't understand the Buddhist teachings. If you really understood these teachings, you'd be ecstatic if your child wanted to go forth. You would say, get yourself over to the monastery straight away. What a wonderful thing that is. That's what you would say, yeah? Because this is it. This, if you want to find the meaning of life, it's right there. Everything else is secondary. So it's only because people don't understand. My parents were exactly the same. They were shocked when I wanted to become a Buddhist monk. What? Become a and but sometimes it pays off to be stubborn. Sometimes you have to know what you want to do. And of course, it turns out that I was very right about that decision, even though I didn't really know myself 100% what I was doing. It was just a strong pull, and I had a feeling I was doing the right thing. Yeah. So this is why that is mentioned in the suttas. You are of the Sakyan clan. You're part of the aristocracy of ancient India, the top of the social hierarchy. You got everything. Still you go forth. Yeah? Wow, what's going on here? That kind of piques your interest when you hear that. And that's why this is mentioned. And he has arrived at Kesaputta, and not only has he gone forth from a good family, but also this good report has been circulated about the Buddha. Yeah, and this is that good report, and this which is coming up now is the standard reflection on the Buddha that you find throughout the suttas. When the Buddha says that we should do Buddha Nusati, which is the reflection on the Buddha, this is the way the Buddha suggests that we should think about him. Yeah, so this actually is very interesting. You know the Itipiso chant? Itipiso? Itipiso Bhagava Arahang Samma Sambuddho Vijja Charana Sampanno. Yeah, but this is it. That's what this is. And this is what it means in English. So if you don't know if you're only used to saying it in Pali, this is the English meaning. That blessed one is an arahant, perfectly awakened, accomplished in insight and conduct, fortunate, knower of the world, unsurpassed, leader of tameable people, teacher of devas and humans, the awakened one, the blessed one. Yeah, so that is that Itipiso chant that you, many of you, especially if you are traditional Buddhist, very likely that you have heard it, because it is one of the most fundamental kind of ways of thinking about Buddhism, really. Yeah. So I usually like to spend a little bit of time on this to explain what this is about, because if we can gain a degree of familiarity with the Buddha, it's almost as we are drawing the Buddha closer to us. He becomes more of our teacher if we start to get a feeling for who the Buddha actually is. So I like to talk a little bit about this. I'm not sure how long I will talk about it, but let's see what happens. So the first part here, that blessed one is an arahant. What is the idea of arahant? And the idea of arahant in ancient India, it's someone who has perfected the path, yeah, spiritually perfected person. And I believe in my recent translations of the Vinaya, I actually translate arahant as a perfected one or perfected person. So it is like the idea of the perfected saint. Yeah, so this is kind of the root or the kind of the traditional meaning of this word. But the root meaning of the word is actually the worthy one, someone who is worthy. What are they worthy of? And what they are worthy of is our respect. They are worthy of our charity, worthy of our hospitality and all of these kind of things. That is what they are worthy of. And the reason is, and we shall see this in a second, is precisely because they have discovered the most fundamental things about human nature. They have really understood the predicament of existence to the all the way to the very root causes. And because of that, they have the ability to impart on us this knowledge, this understanding. Yeah, they are the top teachers in the world because they can teach you the most important things about life. That is really what it is. And I have reflected on this, and it is actually it is very powerful. They are worthy. Sometimes I like to compare the Buddha to other beings. Yeah, and to think, well, who is more worthy? Is there anyone in the world more worthy than the Buddha? Well, if you look around samsaric existence of ordinary beings, it doesn't seem so. But let's take, as an example, a creator god. Yeah, let's say for a moment that maybe Christianity is right. Maybe there is a creator god. I'm not saying Christianity is right. No, I'm just saying this is just an experiment. Yeah, I don't believe in any creator god, but let's say it as an experiment. Let's say there's a creator god. And who is more worthy of respect, the creator god or the Buddha? Now, if there is a creator god, first of all, that creator god, compared to the Buddha started off as an ordinary human being. Then through his own effort, through his own wisdom, through his own practice, he was able to transform his ordinary human existence, just like ours, starting with defilements, starting with wrong views, starting with all kinds of suffering. He was able to transform that ordinary human existence into becoming a perfected human being. Yeah, taking the human condition to its highest potential, eliminating all suffering, finding real happiness in the world, finding the meaning of life, for goodness sake. For goodness sake is okay. In the process, yeah? And how impressive isn't that? How worthy of respect isn't that? Isn't that absolutely astonishing that anyone can actually do that? We are all trying to be his disciples, all trying to follow in his footsteps, and still it is so hard sometimes. It is absolutely astonishing that somebody can do that. It is worthy of tremendous respect. And then you take this creator God who has never done anything. Yeah, he's been sitting there in the heavenly realm or whatever it is. I don't really know how to say it. I shouldn't make too much fun out of the creator God. But he's always been there. Yeah, he'd never done anything. He was never born in the first place. He's always been perfect, always been for all powerful, always been all loving. Well, that's what they say, but you wonder when you read the Bible if that's actually true. And, you know, has never done anything to actually achieve that position. Yeah, there's no kind of merit in what the creator God is. So if you look at it like that, what is more impressive? You know, the Buddha is just miles ahead. Yeah, the Buddha has actually done something with his life, actually achieved something. The creator God has just been sitting there on his bottom, doing nothing. Yeah, I don't know if creator gods have bottoms, but, you know, if they have bottoms, that's what they would be doing. Yeah. I do apologize if I'm being insensitive. If anybody finds this offensive, I do apologize. But this is the way I kind of think about this. It's just my personal way, I suppose. So, and then comes the other interesting thing, yeah? And the other interesting thing is that the Buddha then goes out and teaches this to the whole world and says, this is the path I have discovered. If you want to be happy, practice the same path, do the same thing. He gives this wonderful gift to humanity to enable us to achieve the same happiness. What does the Creator God do? The Creator God is perfectly happy. Everything is wonderful. He's all-powerful and all-loving. And then he creates the universe. And creating the universe, well, what does that mean? Was that a good thing or a bad thing? Well, if you look at what the universe is like, yeah, there's lots of problems in this universe, lots of people suffering. It looks like it was a pretty bad idea, yeah? So here you are, you do nothing, nothing for eons and eons, and then one day you do one act, and that act turns out to be really bad. Yeah? Yeah, that's essentially what it is. There's a beautiful line. I was mentioning Douglas Adams yesterday in The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy. And one of the kind of famous lines in The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy is something like this, you know. In the beginning, God actually says, in the beginning, the universe was created. But really what he means, I think, because he was an avowed atheist, Douglas Adams, in the beginning, God created the universe. That made many people very angry, and it was generally regarded as a bad move. Yeah, that's what he says in the Hitchhiker's Guide, or maybe in the restaurant at the end of the universe. Anyway, one of his famous books, yeah? And that's exactly right. He's got it spot on. It was regarded as a bad move because it was a bad move. From a Buddhist point of view, why do you create all this suffering? And now we are stuck with the problem, and we have to try to get out of it again, yeah? It's, you know... So again, if you start to look at this and you compare the Buddha to the so-called creator God, yeah, who is actually worthy of more respect, there is no comparison. Why do we even worship this creator God? The reason why we worship the creator God is because many people take the creator God to have an influence on our affairs. So we worship the creator God and then we ask for favors. Yeah, oh, please help me, you know, things are so difficult. Or if you don't want that, please give me a new car or whatever. People ask for all kinds of things from the creator. And it's kind of... It's a bit pathetic, yeah? This creator God is there, and because he is all-powerful, and then you worship them, and you ask for these kind of silly things. It's all a bit silly at the end of the day. And the reason why I think we are stuck as a humanity with these ideas of a creator God and all of these things is because that these things have been kind of brought forward in the Western culture. These ideas are actually very ancient. They go back 2,000, 3,000, 4,000 years. They go back to ideas in the Middle East, yeah, where all these Abrahamic religions arose, Islam, Judaism, Christianity, they arose in the Middle East. And they go back to a very, very primitive society, a very primitive outlook. But because they have influenced the Western culture so profoundly, you grow up with these ideas, you never really think about them. When you start to think about them, actually, they don't make much sense at all. They're really absurd. And this is kind of what happened to me after I started becoming a Buddhist. I started to think about Christianity with a bit more clarity. I was starting wondering, why are we even doing this anymore? These are just silly ideas that are part of our culture that are no longer relevant to our society. Yeah, and I didn't grow up in a religious family at all. I barely ever went to church. But the ideas were so saturated in Western society that even if you're not religious, they still kind of permeate the culture and that sort of thing. So you have to withdraw a little bit. You have to stand on the outside and then look back in. And then when you look back in, you wonder, wow, what is this? It is just silly. Yeah, how can anybody really believe this? Anyone who thinks about this properly and who is not desperate for, you know, something will see this as not making much sense at all. So my point here is just to kind of underline the idea that the Buddha is really the highest that we have in the world in terms of understanding, in terms of being worthy of respect, in terms of having the ability to give us something really profound that touches the very essence of who we are as human beings, that can give us freedom from suffering, give us happiness, and give us all of these things. There's nothing in the world more worthy than the Buddha in this respect. And that's why he is the worthy one. This is one of the reasons why he's the Arahant, apart from the fact that he is fully perfected, of course. So let us move on a little bit. So the next one here is perfectly awakened. Yeah, Sambuddho. And the idea of being perfectly awakened can be seen from many different vantage points, many different angles. You are perfectly enlightened because you have, of course, made an end of suffering. That's a very important one. You have achieved the highest happiness. That's one way of looking at it. Another way of looking at it is as, you know, seeing reality as it actually is. This is actually very important. If you want to understand happiness and suffering in the world, you have to see things, first of all, in accordance with reality. If you don't see things in accordance with reality, you cannot make decisions according to reality. If you are deluded, that's what not seeing things according to reality means. It means that you are deluded. You cannot make the right decisions because you don't know where happiness truly lies. So you have to be able to see the world for what it actually is. Yeah, non-self being one of the most important, the root things that you see according to reality. Seeing suffering, seeing impermanence and all of these things. So that is one way of looking at being fully awakened. Another one is in terms of the three knowledges. We'll have a look at that in a second. Another way of seeing it is at getting rid of the defilements of the mind, these things that distort our outlook. And again, it is this ability to see things in the right way. But the most important thing really that it comes back to is the idea of overcoming all suffering and achieving the highest happiness. This is the root thing because it is the thing that everyone can relate to. Yeah, this we can understand. Everybody wants to overcome suffering. Everyone wants to be happy. This is just kind of one of the deepest yearnings in us. This feeling is everything we do is always trying to move towards some better, preferable state in our lives. So that is ultimately what it comes down to. But we will this will come out more clearly what this means as we go through this. He is accomplished in true knowledge and conduct, vijja charana sampanno. And true knowledge here, vijja again, is like insight, the opposite of avijja that we saw just a second before in the previous sutta, avijja also being the beginning of the dependent origination. So this is the opposite of that, having the true knowledge, the insight, the understanding. And the way that that is traditionally explained in the suttas is as the te vijja. Te is the word three. Yeah, this is Pali. Pali is related to English. It's also related to Sinhala. It's related to a large number of languages. Te and three are related words. That's why they sound quite similar. Te vijja, three knowledges, three insights. What are they? Insight of past into past lives, insight into the law of karma, and insight into the awakening experience itself. Yeah, three insights. And so this is what we mean by true insight in Buddhism. It's fascinating. If you want real insight, this is kind of the areas where you have to go. And this tells you something about the difference between just having faith in rebirth and actually having the insight in rebirth. Insight means seeing it for yourself. Faith means, yeah, I accept rebirth. And there's a massive difference between the two. Yeah, if you just have faith that there is rebirth, it may not actually do very much. It may not have much of an impact on you. It may not propel you forward on the path or do anything like that. But when you have an insight into these things, what you are seeing, you are starting to understand the nature of the Four Noble Truths. You're starting to understand what suffering is all about. Yeah, the first of these te vijjas is roughly equivalent to the First Noble Truth. When you see rebirth, you are largely understanding the nature of suffering itself. Because that is what it is to see this samsaric existence, the roaming around aimlessly from one life to another one. Yeah, going on and on and on. That is what it is like. And the way this is explained, the way this insight is explained in the suttas is actually very fascinating. These te vijjas, first of all, the Buddha says, it's like the light being turned on. Yeah, you have been fumbling around in darkness before, not knowing where you're going, trying not to knock your head against, you know, against all the painful things in samsara. Yeah, trying to kind of step in the right place. You don't cut yourself or whatever. But because it's dark, because you don't know what you're doing, you're always knocking against things. You're always suffering as a consequence. One day, somebody turns on the light. Bang! Wow, this is what it's like. And because you can see, for the first time, you can see the exit route. Yeah? The exit route, sir. You see the sign, where the Eightfold Path is, the way out. And then because you do that, you actually find your way out of samsara. The idea that delusion is a darkness, ignorance is a darkness. You don't know what's happening. And then the light gets turned on when one day you actually find the way out of this. Or the other simile, which is also is very beautiful, that I always like to mention on this retreat, because it's such a beautiful, to me, very powerful simile, is the simile of the chick, little chick, yeah, little chick in the egg before it has kind of hatched and come out of the egg. And when it's inside the egg, that is what it's like before you see your past lives, before you see this stream of lives going on potentially endlessly into the future and also into the past. You can't find any beginning in the past either. That's what it's before you see that, you're like the egg. And then one day, as the chick becomes more powerful and stronger and it grows inside the egg, one day it starts to hatch. It uses little claws, its little beak, and pokes a hole in the eggshell, and eventually it comes out, and then it sees the world outside, yeah? The world is so limited in the egg. All you can see is this wall in front of you, kind of going around you, yeah? This is what the eggshell is like. That is what the world is like for most of us. We are all in eggshells. Yeah, do you feel like you're in an eggshell? Yeah, it doesn't feel like it. Yeah, you can't really grasp what it means even to being in an eggshell. But that's what the Buddha says, you're in an eggshell. No, I'm not. Yes, you are. And one day, you break out of that eggshell. You open, the world opens up, and what you see is this. Yeah, just like now in this life. Imagine the chick coming out and seeing all of us sitting here, wondering, what are we doing sitting around like this? Yeah, and seeing the Jhana Grove Retreat Center, seeing the monastery, seeing the whole world and all the madness in the world and what is going on. Yeah, that's what you see when you come out of that eggshell. That is what the Buddha says. It is like to see your past lives. It's a very, very powerful simile because it shows you the a degree to which we are deluded about reality. We have a very narrow perspective on what life really is about. And we really need to get out of that eggshell. Only then do you see what's going on. Then you start to understand suffering. There's a very strong correlation here between the first noble truth and the first vidya, the first insight into past lives. So that is the first vidya the Buddha attains. The second vidya is the vidya understanding, if you like, kamma, how our actions are the things that lead us to various types of rebirth, the connection between action and rebirth, the connection between action and how we experience life right now. So by living well, we move in the right direction. By living badly, we move in the wrong direction. Yeah, this is the second breaking out of the eggshell. Rebirth, kamma, third one is awakening itself, seeing finally, understanding non-self fully, understanding that the five khandhas, a human being, is just a process moving on through existence. There's nobody really home. There's nobody there. There's nothing really worth looking after in those five khandhas. You can chuck them all out because ultimately they're all suffering. Yeah. That's the final insight, the most profound one, the most difficult one to understand. So this is the te vidya, the vidya of this path. And the second of these te vidyas, the understanding of kamma, that is very closely related to the second of the noble truths. Yeah, second of the noble truths is the origin of suffering. Kamma is about the origin of samsara, how it keeps on carrying on. And the third noble truth, the third vidya, is equivalent to the third noble truth, the becoming an arahant, the ending of suffering. Yeah, that is like the insight, the final insight into existence when you see everything. And the fourth noble truth is kind of implied in all of that. The path comes along as well. That's an interesting perspective, how the Te Vidya are actually very closely related to the Four Noble Truths. They're just a particular way of looking at them. So this is the insight the Buddha has. Yeah, and then, of course, not only does the Buddha have insight, the Buddha also has conduct. The Buddha acts the part. The way he speaks is how he lives. The way he lives is how he speaks. Yeah, so when you see the Buddha, the Buddha, or anyone who is an arahant, or anyone who has gotten anywhere on the path, they are transformed. They are different. They are no longer the way most ordinary people are. When you remove the defilements from a person, their outer behavior also changes. Their conduct is different. And this is good news, yeah? Why is this good news? Well, it's good news because it means that we have a means by which we can judge whether somebody is awakened or not. If somebody is angry and full of greed and desire and ill will and kind of is deluded or whatever, you know they can't possibly be enlightened. Angry people are not enlightened. Greedy people are not enlightened. Yeah, Rajneesh Osho, that famous scallywag there's been apparently was a TV series on recently, I heard, called The Wild Wild Country. Thank you. Wild Wild Country, yeah. Right? It was basically a documentary about Osho, about Rajneesh. And he was greedy, yeah? And he had, he had the largest fleet of Rolls Royces anyone has ever had. And he was supposed to be a spiritual leader. Yeah? That kind of doesn't work, yeah? If you have a large fleet of 50 Rolls Royces, that's not usually what proper spiritual leaders have. So this is the idea, is that you have to act the part. You have to become, basically, that teaching, become that those qualities that you are teaching. And this is what the Buddha is. He acts the way he is. So remember that. There's always that possibility of making some degree of judgment about who actually has gone anywhere or gone somewhere on this path. If they have the right qualities, there is a chance they have gone in the right direction. If they haven't got those good qualities, well, there is good grounds, at the very least, to be skeptical. Yeah, it's very hard to be absolute. I would never recommend you to be absolute in your judgments because absoluteness is very, very difficult. But you can have rough ideas, yeah, and that is all that really matters. You have some idea where to place your confidence and trust and some ideas where not to place that confidence and trust. So crazy wisdom is not usually wisdom at all. Yeah, it's usually just crazy. So this is what I mean by having some judgment about these things. So, accomplished in true knowledge and conduct, fortunate, the sugato literally means the one who has gone to a good place, sugato, gone well, he's achieved happiness, yeah? The happy one is a possible translation of that. Knower of the world, loka vidu. Yeah, what does it mean to know the world? Again, there are different ways of looking at that. One of the ways of looking at that is to thinking of this in terms of different planes of rebirth and all of these kind of things. But really, what it means to me, the idea of knowing the world, is to know happiness and suffering fully in its full extent. That's really what it means. Yeah, to be able to decide what is the right thing to do, to be able to decide whether, you know, we should find the perfect kind of rebirth and get reborn in the perfect place, or whether it's worth getting out of samsara or whatever, you have to have a full understanding of happiness and suffering. Yeah, in all its potential, in all its various ways. And once you have a full understanding of happiness and suffering, that is when you can actually make a decision whether there is happiness to be found in this world or whether you have to get out of the wheel of samsara altogether. What is the right way of looking at this? So this is what I think is the meaning of knower of the world. And what that means, first of all, it means that, you know, first of all, you have to know the human existence. What is human existence like? Is it possible to find perfect happiness in human existence? Or is it always going to be problematic? Secondly, you have to know about the idea of rebirth. Because if you don't have any idea of the idea of rebirth, you don't really, again, it is too narrow a view. You don't know what's going on. And then you have to know what kind of rebirths you can have. What are the potentials of happiness and suffering, not just as a human being, but as any kind of being. Let's say you can be reborn as an animal. Let's say you can be reborn as a spirit somewhere. Yeah. If that is the case, what kind of happiness and suffering is possible in all of these various realms or rebirths that you can possibly have? Let's just assume that that is, you know, there are these realms for a minute. And then when you have mapped out all potential for happiness and suffering, whether it is permanent and impermanent and all of these kind of things, only then can you make a decision about what is the right approach to life. Because only then do you know what is possible within samsaric existence. Yeah, so this is what you do. And one way of thinking about this, this is one way I like to think about the idea of rebirth and also of other realms, because for many people who are, especially if you're reborn in like a Western culture, the idea of different realms often sounds very foreign and different and kind of, well, what is this all about? Because we're not used to the ideas. That's basically the reason. It's all about habit and being used to. If you're born in a Buddhist country and you're used to these ideas, it's very easy. Why? Because you're used to them. If you're not used to them, it's hard. Why? Because you're not used to them. It's really just the habits of the mind. That's all it is. So one way of looking at this is to think of human existence. Yeah, human existence has a certain specter, a certain scope or span of various kinds of happiness and suffering that you can have. You can maybe be reborn in a very poor and war-torn country with no wealth, and maybe you are a bit dumb as well, you haven't got much intelligence, yeah, and you are sick and all these kind of things. It's like the very lowest possibility, if you like, on the human, in human existence. But then you can be reborn in a really wealthy place. You can, maybe you are intelligent, maybe you have got all everything going for you in life, yeah, everything is right for you. Maybe you are even at the very top of the kind of human hierarchy. So humanity has this kind of, this kind of broad, quite kind of a certain degree of difference within it. Now, if you want to think about rebirth beyond the human realm, all you have to do is stretch out the range you can find within humanity and take it further. Below that most poor and unfortunate person who is born in a very difficult place, in very difficult circumstances, maybe the person is even depressed, that is to add to the problems. Below that, you can go way below that, and go even further down into more difficulty, more unhappiness. But then on the other hand, the person who is born in the best possible circumstances as a human being, you can go above that into a place that are far more happy beyond that highest of human existence. So all we are doing when we talk about rebirth in different realms, we're just expanding a range that already exists within humanity, and it goes further. Let's say if you get reborn as a deva, as a kind of a spirit being, happy spirit being, what is it like? It's not like anything. Yeah, suddenly you're just a deva. You die, and one day you are a deva. Whoop! What happened? My body is different. Yeah, it's transparent. It's kind of luminous or whatever. Oh, this is pretty cool. Yeah, and then you kind of carry on as a deva. It's just you being reborn there. It's nothing really, kind of astonishing about it. And the same thing if you get reborn as a ghost, for example. I wouldn't recommend that, but it happens. Yeah, oh no, I'm a ghost. No, this is terrible. How did this happen? I should have done more good karma. Why didn't I go more to the monastery? Why didn't I go on those retreats? Why didn't I listen more to the suttas and the Dhamma? Oh, now it's too late. Okay, whatever. Yeah, you're a ghost. You're really, really sad and miserable. And then some of your good friends from life before, they come and make merit on your behalf. And oh yeah, please give more. And you get happy maybe because of that. And you get reborn in a good place after all. So think about those poor ghosts, yeah? And make some merit on their behalf. Every time you make merit on behalf of somebody, your deceased family, whatever it is, you're always going to reach someone. Remember that. There's a sutta about that as well. There's a sutta about everything. Yeah, remember that. There's a sutta about everything. I almost literally mean that. It's not that there is a sutta about everything, but you can draw out the meaning of the suttas in such a way that there is answers pretty much to everything. And there's a sutta with this Brahmin, Janusoni, the Brahmin actually we spoke about the other day, or yesterday. He goes to the Buddha and he says to the Buddha, well, if I give an offering to my deceased family members, will they receive the benefit? And the Buddha says, yes, if they are reborn in the ghost realm, they probably will. But what if they're not reborn in the ghost realm? Yeah, or what if none of my relatives are reborn in the ghost realm? Isn't my gift wasted? And the Buddha replies that it is impossible in this long samsaric existence that you should have no relatives in the ghost realm. You are bound to have relatives in the ghost realm. Yeah, it's impossible not to have it. So whenever you make an offering, on behalf of somebody else, you would always be able to reach somebody. It's a beautiful thing that we can do to support even invisible family members. Yeah, isn't that kind of nice? It kind of broadens out our scope for doing acts of kindness and reaching people who are in desperate need of it because they are in difficult circumstances. Anyway, I'm getting really sidetracked now. But this is what it means by knower of the world, understanding the full scope of happiness and suffering. Only when you understand that can you make an informed decision about samsaric existence and existence in general. Then we have the idea of unsurpassed leaders of tameable persons. Yeah, first of all, you have to be tameable. And if you are here, that usually means that you are tameable. So well done. That's a good start. The Buddha is the unsurpassed leader. Why exactly is he the unsurpassed leader? Well, because first of all, he has the full insight into the human predicament. Yeah, we've just been talking about it, fully understanding everything about suffering and happiness. He has the solution that we're all craving for. We all want this solution because this is the final solution to the thing that we've always been searching for. So he has the highest wisdom. This is what wisdom means. Wisdom is the ability to understand those things that are at the very root of what we want out of our existence. So he has that. On the other hand, he also has the compassion. He has the compassion because he knows he has the answer. And he sees that everyone, all beings out there are suffering. Because he sees that, he also has the compassion. Wisdom and compassion combined. Very powerful combination. And the point here is that it is the purest kind of compassion, the purest kind of metta that you can possibly have. Most teachers in the world, if you are a teacher, you expect something in return. Yeah, I wonder, what about me? What am I expecting in return? I'm trying to think. Maybe some water. Thank you very much, Ananda. But for the Buddha, he expects nothing in return. For the Buddha, it's almost a problem. It's a hassle. It's hard work to go out into the world and teach people. Yeah, the Buddha probably much rather go to a cave, as I was saying the other day, and just meditate. You know, it's actually hard work to teach people in the world. So for the Buddha, it is like a negative vested interest. There's nothing personally that he can get from this. There's no ego that needs to be gratified. There's no physical possessions that he needs because his needs are already met by the alms food of the people and all of this. There is nothing but a negative vested interest. So the compassion is completely pure. And because the compassion is completely pure, he's not going to say anything just to please you. Yeah, he's not going to say anything just to make you happy. He's not going to say anything just to get supporters. Yeah, he's not going to be a crowd pleaser or anything like that. He's going to say things because they are true. He's going to say things to ensure that your long-term happiness is supported and your suffering is reduced in the long term. That is why he's going to teach you. And this has very powerful consequences. It has powerful consequences because it means that when you hear the word of the Buddha, you can be sure that it is pure. We talked about it the other day, that there is nothing excessive in this teachings of the Buddha. There's nothing missing and nothing in excess. Yeah? So it is just the right amount, just what is there. And that is precisely because the Buddha has no vested interest. His only interest is compassion. His only interest is in helping people move away from suffering and finding happiness in their lives. When you think about that, you start to read the word of the Buddha in a new way. You start to realize he's doing this out of compassion. Yeah, not only does he have compassion, but he has compassion for us. This is one of the things that I realized a few years ago as I was reading the word of the Buddha. I realized that he was thinking about us. Yeah, right here in the present day. When the Buddha gave these teachings 2,500 years ago, he deliberately gave these teachings in the language that is very neutral as far as culture and time is concerned. And that is why when we read these suttas now, we can still make sense of them. We don't feel, sometimes they feel a little bit alien because it is a slightly different culture, but most of the time you can relate, especially to the psychological teachings, we can relate to it almost immediately, even though it's 2,500 years difference in time. Even though it is quite a different culture in Australia compared to India, still we can relate to these things. And the reason we can do that is because the Buddha deliberately gave these teachings in a universal kind of language, a language which is always true for people because it touches not the superficial things and what it means to be human, it touches the very core that is universal for all human beings, that is the same everywhere, regardless of culture, regardless of time, regardless of anything else. And that is why when the Buddha taught the Dhammacakkappavattana Sutta, that is why that sutta is called the Dhammacakkappavattana Sutta, setting in motion, yeah? Dhamma, chakka, pavatana. Chakka means wheel. Dhamma is the teaching. Pavatana means to set in motion. Setting in motion the wheel of the Dhamma. The wheel of the Dhamma rolls out into the world. And that wheel rolls on from generation to generation, from culture to culture, across the world, until eventually it goes out of momentum and it falls over and it stops. But in the meantime, as it does that, it rolls on. The Buddha knew that he was setting in motion this wheel of the Dhamma. He knew that he had to teach in a way that is universally acceptable to people everywhere. And that's why he formulated the suttas in this way. For that reason, he was thinking about future generations. He was thinking about us. Yeah, he was thinking not literally about us, but about all these generations in the future. He knew that there would be people coming together 2,500 years later in strange countries where they had strange animals like kangaroos, yeah? And that sort of thing. Yeah? They would come together and listen to these same teachings. So he made it available in this way. Yeah? And when you start to think about that, it is almost as if the Buddha had a direct compassion for us as human beings in this day and age. He is our teacher almost directly because he gave the teachings in such a way that we, specifically we, can understand what they're all about. So think about that, because this brings the teachings alive. It makes the Buddha your personal teacher. It makes the Buddha far more than just this historical personality who had some insight. He actually makes it into your teacher right here and now. When you read these teachings on the paper right here, what you are reading is of a person who was thinking about us 2,500 years later, knowing to phrase these teachings in the right way. When you think about this in the right way, it almost makes your hair stand on end. It is like the Buddha actually is talking to us. Yeah, that's really what it is. And that is not really, I think, exaggerating. That is actually what is going on here. So, I was hoping to get to the end of that sentence, but I think it is... the sentence is too long. Yeah, that's the problem. So, I'm afraid we're going to have to stop there because it's already gone past 4 o'clock. So let's have a break and we'll see you back again at 7:30 this evening here.